Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 94, section 11, which is old single column, page 1038. All right, so we have this final pair of sections to do in this paper about the Melchizedek teachings in the Orient. It's, as you can see from the title here, they want to talk about the evolution of the philosophic frame of Buddhism and how there was genuinely an evolution going on. There wasn't such zealous, you know, false existentialization going on, you know, from the religionists involved, that everything was locked down and immutable. That philosophic frame, especially the higher phases of it, evolved over the centuries, and it eventually evolved to the point that it allowed for a personalization of deity within that frame. It allowed for a budding God, you know, concept to form again, a personal deity concept. So they want to take us through that the basics of that process. I don't think we need to really say much else besides that. Let's just jump in. There's plenty to talk about once we get in here.
Section 11, Buddhist philosophy. Buddhism entered China in the first millennium after Christ, and it fitted well into the religious customs of the yellow race. In ancestor worship, they had long prayed to the dead. Now they could also pray for them. Buddhism soon amalgamated with the lingering ritualistic practices of disintegrating Taoism. This new synthetic religion, with its temples of worship and definite religious ceremonial, soon became the generally accepted cult of the peoples of China, Korea, and Japan.
Okay, the key thing there to kind of get us synced up again with where we left off before, when they said, and it fitted well into the religious customs of the yellow race, many reasons, but the key one that they wanted to highlight, and so we should highlight, remember they were pointing out how in Buddhism you developed the concept of the lesser road and the greater road. Whether or not, and of course, some people call that road like they are here, might call it path or way or even vehicle. But nonetheless, when we were talking about China, we were definitely talking about the way, Dao. And as I mentioned last time, you also have the T-O, in Shinto, right? I mean, that's, God's way, Shinto. You very much have that established, and as we point out, very compelling concept of the way in the Far East. So if nothing else, this road concept in Buddhism, could just strike step without really any modification at all. I mean, it's an abstract, generalized enough concept to begin with that, no problem in syncing up with it. So that's the key issue, and you can see from the rest of what they say in the latter part of that paragraph, the more we go away from the roots in India and the farther removed we are from Gautama himself, more and more and more and more, you get all kinds of evolutionary ritual and superstition and what have you also balled onto this Buddhist snowball that's rolling across Asia. Yeah. We have to all, you know, all of us are very captivated by, you know, the material majesty that the hand of man can construct. I mean, throw in a little bit of gilding or what have you, and we can make some fancy temples that none of us can help it. You know, you walk in and your jaw drops, you stand in awe of the majesty, you know, and the solemnity of some of these places. So it's, you know, when I highlight the revelators, shining a spotlight on those sorts of things, I mean, don't think that I'm suggesting that it's somehow straightforward to move away from thinking of religion as being in that majestic material framing that we've always done with it. But this is indeed what the fifth epical revelation is challenging us to do, to not seek deity there in the outer life, no matter how fancy you make it look and smell and taste and what have you. Right? It's not really there. That's illusion. Right? Remember, go back to the very first paper, very beginning of the very first paper on the evolution of religion. Right? We have to let go of a fear-based, illusion-driven scheme that we call religion. That's not real religion. It's purely inner life. Now, I'm belaboring this a little bit because I'm just, I want to set the context here. You know, why is it that all of that outer life falderall always develops on every world, like we talked about? It's not just an aberration of this world. We're very material by nature. Right? You can't start anywhere else but that. The key is just, as humans develop this fancy outer life scheme, they should also be maturing a more reflective life. And inexorably, when you're awed by material majesty, that should get, that's a little seed for your reflective life to work upon and abstract the essence from that, so that you can leave the substance for what it is, just material substance that's made fancy, right? And abstract an essence from that is a suggestion to you that you can follow up to a new substance, to spirit substance. Right? There's an essence that the two share in common. Let's just think in straightforward terms about what I mean by that. Beauty, take beauty. Right? If you can abstract the beauty from the matter, okay, follow that essence of beauty up, and discover it associated with a higher substance, right? But, as long as you keep the appearance, believe the appearance is a reality, that the beauty is glued to the matter, okay, and hence is not abstractable from it, right? And hence not transferable through it to spirit, right? You can't get there. You have to be willing to let go of that false identification. Right? The beauty only appears to be glued to the matter. It isn't really. Your insight inside is overlaying beauty on the matter. Right? So just follow your overlay back up in and look for the source of that which you projected out and overlaid.
Yeah, you wouldn't even recognize it as beauty if it was only in the matter.
Yeah.
Because what you're just saying, when you take it out, the whole concept of beauty is something that comes, as you said, from within.
Yes,
from,
right.
You know, it just isn't really in the matter at all.
No. But you're overlaying it. You're pasting it on. Yeah,
spark it in you, but you wouldn't even recognize it. Like I doubt that an animal recognizes.
No, I mean an animal has no insight. There's no concept of beauty possible in an animal, right? I mean, like I said, I mean if you think literally about the physics of it, it's amazing to contemplate. I mean, literally, beauty is a quality of the paradise source and center. Right? And your insight is getting a hold of that and projecting it out and overlaying it on matter. I mean, you know, it appears you're seeing beautiful matter, but really you're seeing the beauty of the aisle itself. Okay?
If you recognize it as beauty.
Made manifest through deep mystery, obviously, into your mind. You're pretty darn far removed from the aisle, you know, it's something you can stub your toe on. Okay, but nonetheless, through, basically an infinite descent of grace, right, you can know of that fact, that transcendent fact, and can ignorantly project it onto, you know, something in, you know, in front of your eyes, thinking that it's there.
All the beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. So what you think is beautiful, the other person doesn't, or something like that.
Yeah, and of course that beauty is in the eyes of the beholder thing, you know, is a statement that it's all subjective. See, but what I'm doing is challenging that fundamentally. It's like, no, beauty is an objective fact. It's literally an absolute fact. Okay? You know, at its source. Right? There's an absolute of beauty. The paradise source and center. Okay? It isn't really in the eye of the beholder. I mean, what they're calling beauty is pleasantness, you know, as a subjective thing. Okay? And that's in the quote-unquote eye of the beholder. Okay? But real beauty is not just your subjective pleasure, any more than, that makes me feel pleasant, therefore that's good. You know, any more than goodness, you know, is in the eye of the beholder, right? It's just a subjective pleasure issue. No, there's an absolute of goodness, right? It's absolutely objective, has nothing to do with your subjectivity, really, okay? And to just know that, And then over an eternity of ages to come, seek for that actual source. Right? Never be satisfied with the appearance. Well, it appears that that's the source of beauty. No, not really. I know it's higher. Oh, now that appears. No, really, it's higher. Right? Always know that the real source is ever higher, and that you're just overlaying your insight upon your sight. You're combining insight and sight, and you don't know that until you start to reflect. Right? When the Greeks, ancient Greeks, started to reflect on this, they quickly recognized, oh, beauty's not a property of matter. I'm overlaying that. And they went in quest of this very intangible fact. Well, what is beauty really? Okay? What is it transcendent that quote-unquote, the eye of the beholder, right? That many have completely given up on that, and they decided it was a fool's errand that those ancient Greeks set out upon. It's like, no, okay? I mean, is the Aranchabuk not telling you, right? That beauty, there's an absolute of beauty, that beauty is as an objective fact, has nothing to do with your ignorance or your poor sight or your education or anything. Truth, beauty, goodness, right? I mean, that isn't three flavors of subjective pleasure, right? Like everyone tends to think of them these days. Well, there's my truth and there's your truth. I mean, it's like, yeah, truth is in the eye of the beholder. No, truth is not in the eye of the beholder. There's real truth.
I'm always reminded when Jesus first saw Jerusalem as a child, it brought up intense feelings in him of, you know, how beautiful it was. Mm-hmm. And but when he entered Jerusalem for the last time, he stood on the hill and wept.
Yeah, at how grotesque it was.
But I think it's what you're saying is different than that. You know, to me anyway, the spirit behind the whole concept of beauty, you wouldn't even have. In other words, like if you look at a beautiful, there you go, beautiful maple tree, changing this time of year and it's red,
yeah.
And you say, well, that looks really beautiful.
Right.
Well, it's still a red maple tree, you know, but you wouldn't even, without the spirit understanding and without inside you, I think coming from the third source and center, you know, originally, to be able to know beauty or be able to even recognize or have beauty, you wouldn't even see it as beautiful. I think that what you're saying to me anyway is that the true source behind beauty, truth, and goodness is really, you know, way in the, you know, in the deity aspect of life, so to speak, or in the beginning, it's there, given to you, and you wouldn't even, if you didn't have it from a spiritual point of view, you wouldn't even recognize something as being
right.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't have the concept.
Yeah.
That's
definitely what I was immediately speaking to. And he's just bringing in an additional element upon that foundation of, you know, and properly recognized that, again, like I said, I mean, you're overlaying insight on sight. That's fundamentally what's going on. It's like, well, what if, you know, you start to really recognize something for what it is? You won't be as inclined to overlay beauty on it like you used to. See, and it won't appear beautiful anymore. It can go all the way the other way and appear grotesque to you. See, because it's in your hands, that overlay, right? And so when you have certain illusions about something, like, you know, the young Jesus had all kinds of illusions, you know, from what he'd been told about the temple and its doings, right? He was overlaying his internal, you know, insight upon that vista. But he wasn't as inclined late in life to do that, right? I mean, he knew that wasn't the reality of it. So, you know, just, you know, that all it says is just what I was saying up front. You know that fundamentally. Don't be satisfied with the appearance. Someone can appear to be integrous. Then you get to know them better. Okay? And see, I mean, and you'll even have, you know, remember initially you'll have an inclination, well, they've changed. No, they haven't changed at all. They're exactly like they always were to the objective eye. Right? It's just you now recognize them more for what they are. I mean, another parallel. Yeah, we talk about all the time. You know, forget about going to Havona or the Isle of Paradise, you know, where initially you can't see anything, experience anything. I mean, just, you know, you're on the first mansion world and you take your first trip to Gerasim and you take it all in, you know, and then you finally graduate to the second mansion world and you take a trip to Gerasim and you go, whoa, they've changed everything, right, is what you say. No, they haven't changed anything. You've changed, right? That, you know, we have to always keep in mind, you know, that that difference between appearance and reality, right? And seek for the actual fact of beauty, not for the material objects or experiences upon which they appear. It appears to be glued.
Don't they talk about, you know, as you become a Marantia being, that you become, you look on the outside like you are on the inside. When they use the example, a lot of people may look beautiful here on Earth, but they're not really so
right.
cool on the inside.
Right.
And they look not so good out here on Earth,
yeah.
and they're really cool on the inside.
Right.
So, I mean, in terms of what you're saying about you get there and you say, oh, it's changed. But, you know, in fact, you do change, I'm sure. You must grow more beautiful on the outside as you grow more beautiful
yeah,
on the inside.
Yeah, of course. Some of the people have grown since the last time you saw me. Yeah, I mean, there's that issue. But I'm just, you know, I'm just talking about the environment, basically. It's like, you know, that building wasn't there before. It's like, no, you just couldn't see that building. Now you can. Okay. Right, that building is not growing and becoming, you know, more embodied with truth, beauty, and goodness or whatever, and is showing on the outside of the Marantia body. Or no, it's the exact same building it always was. Just like...
just wasn't there.
Yeah, right. It's just, yeah, like you say, you go to the pilot world of, you know, the Seventh Circuit of Avona, and there's absolutely nothing there. So it appears. Right? And then then you get there really... you know, and it's infinitely complex. You think, wow, they've really built it out since I first got here.
You guys have been
like, not one iota has changed. Right, you just couldn't see it. That just couldn't see it. I was just, you know, a little bit ago, I was pointing out, remember, it goes both ways. Right? I couldn't see its beauty before. I couldn't see its ugliness before. Right. I mean, we start innocent, little children. We have our initial inclination is to paste beauty on everything. Right? We don't start out cynical. Right? So you project, paste that beauty on everything. Truth, beauty, and goodness, you just paste it on everything.
Little kids will put anything in their mouth.
Right. Oh,
look at that.
Like, no. And eventually you recognize, nope, that was a false identification. That is not a beautiful object. I shouldn't have been gluing beauty onto that. okay.
Disillusionment comes to mind.
Yes. All right, let's keep going here.
Well, in some respects, it is unfortunate that Buddhism was not carried to the world until after Gautama's followers had so perverted the traditions and teachings of the cult as to make him a divine being. Nonetheless, this myth of his human life, embellished as it was with a multitude of miracles, proved very appealing to the auditors of the Northern or Mahayana gospel of Buddhism.
Yeah. So it had welcome ears there, the auditors of this new gospel that was being brought to their land.
Auditors.
You know, auditory, you know, listeners, you know.
Oh, okay.
You know, those who were exposed to it, you know, and were listening to the teachings. You know, if you just join a class to listen to what's being said, you're auditing the class. You know, like that.
They're not auditing your books.
Yeah, not like an IRS audit.
Later on,
see how that word has been perverted? to that point, you know, notice that they said it again. See, they repeated it. Right. It's a grotesque perversion on its surface now. But nonetheless, like they say, even grotesque perversions have their place in an evolutionary process. But obviously there's going to come a time when the grotesque perversion doesn't masquerade as beautiful anymore and no longer helps you progress in spite of yourself. Right? Eventually, it's seen for what it really is. Okay, and then it's not going to work anymore as an evolutionary propellant. And you're going to need to seek for something higher up, something less illusory. Okay, but it was carried out far and wide. Even though you've got Gautama now as a divine being, And it, just like with Jesus, right? It's all about the miracles. That's what's so exciting. You know, the Buddha as a material technique, right? You know, even if you don't, you know, the religionist, some particular religionist doesn't think of the material technique as being active right now in their immediate in their life. They delight in thinking back to a time when, you know, the material technique, you know, of divinity was manifest on the world, was made flesh, and, you know, and the molecules danced, you know, in delight. Okay, that material technique thing is just always polluting. We're always wanting to turn it into a some sort of fancy material technique that we can reverence. All right.
Some of his later followers taught that Sakyamuni Buddha's spirit returned periodically to Earth as a living Buddha, thus opening the way for an indefinite perpetuation of Buddha images, temples, rituals, and imposter living Buddhas. Thus did the religion of the great Indian Protestant eventually find itself shackled with those very ceremonial practices and ritualistic incantations against which he had so fearlessly fought and which he had so valiantly denounced.
Okay, so history repeats itself, as it were, just like Hinduism focused on Vishnu and produced an infinite number of avatars, you know, incarnations. Okay, we got the Buddhist version of that same scheme. You know, and so we're going to have Buddhas, you know, filling the entire landscape, right? In short order. Yeah, right. Yeah, not to mention the literal, you know, idol objects, yes.
You get it at Walmart.
But you notice it said living Buddhas. Okay.
Just put a water fountain in it.
Yes, yes. And, you know, remember, Sakyamuni is a sage of the Sakya clan. So many refer to him in that way. Again, kind of see abstracting all the more, kind of leaving his name behind. And he's just a mystic sage from ages past. Like I said, see, an indefinite perpetuation of Buddha images, temples, etc. Because, like we saw, with every single scheme that evolutionary religion ever dreamt up, it only does one thing. It gets more and more and more complicated as the generations roll on. Right? So you've opened that whole Pandora's box, as it were, in this regard. A very problematic complexity that eventually someone is going to have to try to step in and deal with philosophically. So, that's foreshadowing coming paragraphs here. Anything else there? Let's see. Just that you've got this great Indian Protestant here, he was so definitively standing in protest of all of that evolutionary silliness of rituals and superstitions and whatnot, but the material gravity, has drug everything all the way back down. So it's shackled with those very ceremonial practices and ritualistic incantations that he had worked so hard to liberate the people from.
sounds like 10,000 years after the prince's staff. Yeah. Same kind of pattern seems to happen.
Right, right. I mean, it's just material gravity. It just drags everything back down to that, that unenlightened, you know, that natural state, which is what we, like I said, what we read about. It's all this foolishness that gets more and more and more complicated as the generations roll by and becomes, as they said about Tibetan Buddhism, inordinately cumbersome and intolerantly burdensome. It's just the way it is. Some are, you know, not everyone is on steroids like the Tibetan Buddhists, but, you know, it's basically the same story everywhere. All right, keep going.
The great advance made in Buddhist philosophy consisted in its comprehension of the relativity of all truth. Through the mechanism of this hypothesis, Buddhists have been able to reconcile and correlate the divergences within their own religious scriptures, as well as the differences between their own and many others. It was taught that the small truth was for little minds, the large truth for great minds.
Works right into the lesser road, greater road mode, right? Now, this is coincidentally, weren't we just, you go, wait a minute, wasn't Chris just talking about this whole truth is in the eye of the beholder? Aren't they saying Chris didn't know what he's talking about, the relativity of all truth? No. Okay. That doesn't mean that it's subjective, that it's in the eye of the beholder. Okay. Not relative subjectively, it's relative objectively. And we talk about this often as we try to get one of the basic principles of the fifth epical revelation, that wholeness, you know, like Mother Deity, exists in a vertical hierarchy. Okay? The entire hierarchy is objective. Right? And it goes all the way up to absolute truth, right? Which is objective, obviously. But, you know, sub-absolute truth is still objective, right? You know, the wholeness of a local universe, just to take a, you know, the literal cosmological thing that you can focus on, right? The wholeness of a local universe, one turning, right, is not some non-objective, subjective deceit, you know, upon the upon the universe. No, I mean, it's objective wholeness. It's just down in the hierarchy, right? There's a genuine objective wholeness at that level. There's an objective wholeness above that at the super universe level, etc. You know, that's sort of wholeness made, made overt cosmology. Just, you know, think about it like that. But think about it in general, right? There's a whole spectrum of the cosmos and of the wholeness at every level.
A local
whole. Right. Yes. Right. Oh. You know, and I mean, and it's much more finely leveled, you know, than it appears from just that you know, that rough space cosmological manifestation of local universe, super universe. I mean, yeah, you have a very finely, you know, demarked series of levels. When you talk about moving up the seven levels of mortal wisdom, well, once you begin to synthetically transcend, moving up, you know, of the levels of meaning, you know, you transcend that and work on, you know, work at things at a higher synthetic level. Right? I mean, each of those levels of wisdom is a level of wholeness, right? You know, and it's not subjective, it's objective, right? There's a complete whole package here at level one, complete whole package at level two, right? It's just there's a relativity to wholeness, you know, and one of those aspects of wholeness, sort of the shadow cast, into from eternity into wholeness is truth. Truth is a holistic, so there's a relativity to truth. Okay. And that's That's a very important thing to appreciate about truth, right? To bring in experiential deity so that you have a relativity of truth. When you only have existential deity, when all you have is some Western father concept, right? You have this false dichotomy you set up between no truth and absolute truth and nothing in between. Right? There's that strong tendency, you know, coming from the West. They're pointing out, especially amongst the Buddhists, right, in the East, right, they were getting, you know, they didn't recognize it, but they were getting experiential deity in this vertical hierarchy, right? Predicated on, you know, the most general aspect of that experiential deity, mother deity, you know, in contrast to father deity. So that's a very important thing, you know. I mean, there is objective truth, period. It's not in the eye of the beholder. Sure, it's just on level one, not level 95, but still, it's objective, right? Even us lowly blobs of protoplasm mostly can have objective consciousness as far removed from some absolute consciousness as you can get, but still, you can have objective consciousness.
Meaning what?
Meaning you can really see the wholeness of the level you're on. The real wholeness.
Versus subjective.
You can get outside of you the part and start with the whole and then re-see yourself as a part in the context of that whole. You can see yourself objectively. You start with the objective frame. And then, you know, of the whole, and then you see yourself as a part in that context. Without that, when you're looking bottom up, you know, you project the part into an illusory whole. You know, that's that ismizing sort of phenomenon of taking some part and, you know, and deeming it to be the whole. The first thing you want to ismize is yourself. Right, yeah. As we were talking, about truth, beauty, and goodness. Right, you define truth, you define beauty, you define goodness. See, you define the qualities of the whole by projecting your subjective pleasure points outward. I find the color green pleasant. You know, therefore, green is good. I don't find the color, you know, purple pleasant. Therefore, purple is bad, right? I mean, you know, that's a simplistic thing, but I mean, you know, don't think that you don't do something almost exactly like that. It's not literally that, right? When you start out, you can't do anything else but that when you're immature. Project out like that. Right? Can you get humble enough to let go of yourself in that projection into a false whole and actually get the real whole, which you can take a hold of by grace, right? The individuality of the whole, the mother, has by grace given you the ability to know the whole. Okay? And then when you see all the parts from the vantage point of the whole, behold, all things become new. That's what that phrase is about. No longer is it as it appeared before. You see yourself and everything else in its real context. You can engage the nature of things objectively. Oh, now I'm starting to understand what really is going on there.
In fact, becoming a universe citizen in that aspect?
A cosmic citizen, okay, you're a citizen because there's a little representative government, right, in the local universe that you are literally a citizen of, whether you're aware of that or not. But the cosmic modifier, you know, why is it a cosmic citizen? Right, there is a representative government embodied in the whole of the cosmos, the wholeness of the cosmos. Right, the nature of the whole has been projected down and embodied in the parts of the representative government right? And then you're a citizen of that representative government. Yeah? So you're a cosmic citizen, okay? Because the government is cosmic, because it reflects the cosmos that it's in. You're trying to have cosmic consciousness, so your consciousness reflects the cosmos that it's in, as opposed to, well, I have a consciousness, and I think it's the cosmos. Let me project it out and make an illusory cosmos that I exist in. Ooh, it's just like me.
There's a quote that I remember. It goes something like, the only objective thing, God, is only recognized through the subjectiveness. I forget what it is, but it's in the Thought Adjuster papers. And I've always had a hard time understanding the difference, what they're meaning here between objective reality and subjective reality.
Right. Maybe all that objective consciousness I was just talking about, that doesn't change the fact that when the rubber meets the road, right, the forms in your mind are subject to the frame of your mindal self. They're inescapably subjective, okay? So your sensation is inescapably subjective, right? There's no such thing as objective sensation, objective seeing, hearing, feeling or whatever, okay? But your insight, see, transcendent of your sensation recognition can be, if you take delight in cultivating, objective. See, so you've got the subjective appearance, and then you can overlay your objective insight. It's like, well, it appears to be this, but I know through insight that it really is, right? I know the reality behind the appearance, right? So that insight of the reality can be objective.
A different point of view,
in a way? Well, you know... what really makes it look like that, right? I mean, this is the saber-toothed tiger thing, okay? You look at the snarling Hulk, right, with his club and the saber-toothed tiger, and it appears you know what's going on there, but not, you don't really, just by its appearance, right? You can't judge the book by its cover, right? Your insight can see, oh, really, that person isn't debased like he appears. Really, he's quite noble. Right? This is an important thing to know. There's all kinds of, every day, everyone around you is telling you, that person is to be despised. Look at them. They'll pick an image where they're caught between expressions and they have this kind of nasty look on their face. See, right? Your eyes don't lie. That's a nasty person. Like, no. You can't judge it by the sight, especially a deceptive caption of a particular frame of a video, right?
Paparazzi gets paid.
Right. No, you have to. Is that really a debased person? Because they happen to be kind of prickly at the moment, like that caveman? Or are they a noble person? Are they fighting for a noble cause? Sure, they're fighting, and when you're fighting, you're going to have a non-kindly mystic expression on your face. That doesn't mean they aren't noble, right? To thinking that the only noble people who have that kindly mystic fake face plastered on their head, that's silly. Yeah. Right?
And projecting nobility on something that's pleasant, same thing.
Right. Yeah. When you really get to know that false front, that whited sepulcher with the kindly mystic thing pasted on their face, right, the real person is not noble at all, you discover. They're very nasty, self-serving. Right? It's like, that snarling person strikes me as different now than they did before. Right? Yeah, you get exactly the opposite. What you thought was beautiful is ugly, and what you thought was ugly is beautiful. Right? That's the whole bit of that caveman thing, you know, that Starling Hulk thing. Right? It doesn't appear to be beautiful, but it really is. See, that's, see, you know, it's not in the eye of the beholder, really. Right? That's what the Revelation is trying to teach us, you know, with a level of physics specificity that we've never been able to approach it with before, right? We can only kind of just vaguely talk about this stuff, and so vaguely that, you know, eventually everyone goes, oh, we're just kidding ourselves. This is, there's any reality to this.
Is that how come Jesus could love his enemies?
Right. I mean, no matter how much someone's your enemy, they're still a child of God, and that's beautiful. Right? Do you think that something that comes from God is innately ugly, despite all appearances to the contrary? No. Really, that person is beautiful if they're a child of God. I mean, the only way to make that not the case anymore is if they literally go to iniquity so that there isn't any God inside anymore. But if there's God inside, it's innately beautiful. By definition, you know it's beautiful. No matter whether you can see it or not, you know it's there and you know it's beautiful. And you can love that beauty. But see, you know, we can say don't judge a book by its cover until you're blue in the face, but everyone judges a book by its cover. Right? They base their entire worldview on appearances instead of on reality. They shut down all insight, reject it, right? And base everything on sight.
But he did not engage people, too. That was one of his
techniques. Yeah, right. But not. But remember, you know, he passed by a person not because they were ugly.
No, but he didn't have anything to.
But you know, the person had, you know, wasn't taking delight in cultivating enough that there was anything he could work with. It was just pragmatism, right?
That's what it's like for us.
Right. Right. I mean, yeah. But it doesn't, you know. But he never, you know, then, you know, afterwards said to Ganad, the reason I passed by that person is they were absolutely ugly inside. No, he didn't say that, because they were a child of God.
I think you can have a neutral position in that, though. But if somebody is, for instance, manipulating people, and that's all they do, and you know they're doing it, you don't engage them.
Right. You don't
have a neutral way.
Sure.
That's all.
Right. Yeah. See, again, you separate the ideal from the, you know, the pragmatic issues.
It's not saying,
right, you don't engage them because the Father doesn't love them absolutely, and so you're going to do likewise. You know, no. Right? The Father loves them absolutely. That's irrelevant. Right? There's no practical way to work with this person.
Exactly.
Right? They've set their mind to being deceitful in all their ways. I mean, it's like, okay, move on to the next person. But just because they're deceitful in all their ways doesn't mean God doesn't love them absolutely.
Doesn't mean that might have the universe next to the earth and the outer space level
somewhere. Right. Yeah. Okay. Where were we? Right here. Okay.
This philosophy also held that the Buddha, divine nature, resided in all men, that man, through his own endeavors, could attain to the realization of this inner divinity. And this teaching is one of the clearest presentations of the truth of the indwelling adjusters ever to be made by your ancient religion.
Okay, so you have hints at this, you know, in Hinduism, but they're pointing out it's as we've seen before. Because Buddhism just is not as far removed from a personalization concept and hence personal ministry. The adjusters aren't persons, but they're certainly part of the personal ministry of the Universal Father. Okay. That's why they say... is one of the clearest presentations, you know, not of the fact, obviously, right, of the indwelling adjusters, but of the truth of the indwelling adjusters. Right. I mean, this is the first time we've had presentation of the fact, right, of the indwelling of justice. This is in the fifth epical revelation. But there's people who have kind of sort of gotten at the truth of it. Right? And the revelators are always trying to help you get around all of the religious language and falderall, in the way, you know, all these people talk about their ideas, and boil it down to just the clear basics of, you know, what's really there, you know, and especially so that you can see the truth that's really there, right? They coordinate the essential knowledge of Buddhism for you so that in that cleared up, you know, pithy presentation, you can recognize the truth better of what's there. Yeah, yeah. If you just, you know, read the Wikipedia page about some of these things, you know, I mean, your eyes glaze over after one paragraph. It's just, you know, it's insanely unfocused and complicated. I mean, you know, the experts in it really don't know what they're talking about, right? But they put lots of fancy words on the page, right? The revelators clear all that up for you, give you this wonderful, you know, insightful description of what's really there.
The argumentative proposition was inversely.
Yeah. It's just stunning how you know, scholarly sorts can say lots and lots of words and really not say anything. So see, the degree to which you've got this, you know, this idea that Buddha is, you know, like they're saying, is like a divine or deity-like, see, nature, right? And you think of that being in some sense individuated within someone, a fragment of deity, see, you know, a thought adjuster within, right? That's what they're getting at. All right. Let's see, anything else there? The part through his own endeavors, and I was take the light in cultivating, right? And it's and things are in your free will hands, right? As we were just talking before, I mean, the insight of the reality behind a particular appearance is not imposed upon you, right? That's in your free will hands to know or not, right? And you can live falsely based upon the appearance, or you can know the reality behind the appearance and live relative to that and find truth for the first time. Okay.
Just a side note, there's two paragraphs coming up, both beginning with the word but.
You know? Yeah, not only do the revelators start sentences with but, they'll start paragraphs with but. Yes.
But a great limitation in the original gospel of Siddhartha, as it was interpreted by his followers, was that it attempted the complete liberation of the human self from all the limitations of the mortal nature by the technique of isolating the self from objective reality. True cosmic self-realization results from identification with cosmic reality and with the finite cosmos of energy, mind, and spirit, bounded by space and conditioned by time.
Huh, weren't we just talking about this? See, it's innate in what we're talking about. So, of course, and there's where the, you know, no matter what ism it is, Buddhism or, you know, no matter what ism, it often suffers from this problem. Like I said, you're taking a part and pretending it's the whole, right? Which means you're going to be ever more willfully separating yourself from objective reality, okay? And living an illusion. Yeah, there it is right there, see, just exactly what we've been talking about. How unfortunate is that, you know, this ever more, you know, what you think of as devout and holy effort to isolate the self from objective reality. Ah! You know, warning, danger. Now, that's obviously fraught with problems. Okay, the other cool thing is that final sentence.
Yeah.
You've heard me say this many times about the Greek word cosmos. Okay, it has two senses. Right? When they say, so true cosmic self-realization, like I was saying before, where you embody a reflection of the whole of the cosmos within yourself, that results from identification with, so they say two things. One, they just say cosmic reality, and then the other is, and with the finite cosmos of energy, mind, and spirit. Okay, think cosmos has two flavors, you know, to the sense of that word. The first one is the intensive mode, where cosmos means universal harmony. That when they say identification with cosmic reality, they're talking about identification with the universal harmony, right, which is a triunity, right? Thinking of it not in the extensive mode, but in the intensive mode, where just thinking of it as the universal harmony. The second one is the harmonizing universe sense of cosmos. See, the finite cosmos of energy, mind, and spirit, bounded by space and conditioned by time, harmonizing universe. Okay, yeah, and that's the highest mode of kind of quote unquote time. That ing, there's progressing, and then transcendent of that, there's the sequence of perfecting, and then transcendent of that, there's the sequence of harmonizing. Okay. Way back at the beginning of the book when they talk about such things about time. Okay. But they have both the intensive and the extensive modes of the word cosmos there, they're reminding you of. You have a dual identification. Because your the upper domain, your inner life, right, is fundamentally identifying with the universal harmony. And then through self-mastery, you're getting your lower domain identified with the harmonizing universe, right? That's your associating mechanism that engages the extensive world, the external world, bounded by space, right? That's the extensive mode, okay? All right, so both modes, in both ways, right? You want to have this identification. But if you forget that Jesus said seek first and you remember seek only, you're going to have this tendency to be so heavenly minded you're no earthly good and try to just be synchronizing, with an upper domain, that whole bit of isolating the self from objective reality. That's thinking you've got to somehow escape from that lower domain, right? That animal origin benighted thing. And if I can just snip it off, and be free of it, that whole modality of false pursuit. No, you're not going to try to somehow get away from that. You're going to try to get the predicate that you need of a cosmic nature that will allow you to master that. Right, not escape it.
Do something.
Yeah, right. You're going to be something in the upper domain, and you're going to do something with the lower domain.
Sounds unbalanced.
Right. Yeah, obviously, if you try to just be that upper domain, take away the bottom domain. Just look at it visually. Oh, that looks really stable. I bet I can just balance there on that point. No, you're going to fall over. Right. It's not a stable situation. Right? You need that lower domain to be a stable mind. Right? What you need is just to have it harmonized with that external cosmos.
And the lower domain's all the way up. I mean, the whole thing.
Right. In your whole ascension career, you always have a lower domain and an upper domain.
That's That's
yeah, what I mean. Yeah. And every being has a, you know, the eternal Son has an upper domain and a lower domain. Okay? There's only one being that doesn't have a lower domain. Which being is that? The Universal Father. Right? He has no outside. Right? It's the only being in all existence, right, that only has an inner life, an upper domain. Right? And that's why the only place you can find him, the only place of real religion, is the upper domain. Right? The outer domain, the lower domain that engages the external world, where we try to play out religion, that's a false pursuit. There is no Father to be found there. He has no outside. You can't find him, you know, sharing your outside with you. Right?
Who shares the outside with you?
Every other being. An infinite number of other beings.
All others.
Yeah, all the others. Right? Right. They all share, you know, that with you. But there's one being that didn't allow himself to have an outer life so that there could be other outer lives. If he had wanted to have an outer life, that means there's going to be only...
Yeah.
And of course, the moment he has an outer life, you know, it isn't really, because then there's no inside and outside. And so the words actually, yeah, I mean, but theoretically, see, right, for him to have an outer life is to prevent anyone else from having an outer life, even having an existence.
But he does experience through you.
Right. He can engage your inner life. Right?
Is that something to do with subordinate?
That's what Jesus, you know, when Jesus said he's...
Cooperative subordination.
Cooperative subordination. Okay, there's that. But just, you know, the whole bit is, and Jesus said he's your spiritual father. What that means is you can't find him in your outer life. You have a material outer life, okay? The only place you can find him is in your spiritualized mind, the upper domain. That's the only place you can find him. Okay? That's what he was saying between the lines when he said he's your spiritual father. Because he can't say, well, okay, let's think, you know, technically about this. You know, the universal father is a being that has no outside and no beyond. You know, but no, he can't talk technically like that to them, right? But he can say... he's your spiritual father. And it's like, well, what does spirit look like? Well, it doesn't look like that cup right there or this couch cushion. Okay, so, what does it look like? Well, it doesn't look like anything. It's not something you see, right? It's something you have insight into, right? Now, you can find the universal father through insight. You can't find him through sight or smell. You know, the idea that a certain sacrifice was pleasing to the Lord's nostrils. No. He has no nose. He has no outer life. Okay? He can't see you, hear you, feel you. Right? He can't engage you like that. But he can know you. Right? As you just know things, they're self-evident in your inner life. As you know like that, so he can know you. Right? The more you just know, the more he knows your knowing.
Does the Universal Father suffer?
Right? Anyway.
Don't know how.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to go off on kind of addressing that. That's a kind of a whole technical thing to understand self-experiential deity of the Universal Father. But anyway, back to what we've got here.
But though the ceremonies and outward observances of Buddhism became grossly contaminated with those of the lands to which it traveled, this degeneration was not altogether the case in the philosophical life of the great thinkers who, from time to time, embraced this system of thought and belief. Through more than 2,000 years, many of the best minds of Asia have concentrated upon the problem of ascertaining absolute truth and the truth of the absolute.
Okay, so we already kind of into that. You know, they had the recognition of the vertical hierarchy, right, of objective truth. But that immediately you go, ooh, I'd like to seek for the ceiling of that, right? To strive for ascertaining absolute truth, right? The top of the objective hierarchy of truth. And then, you know, the companion with that is the truth of the absolute, right? That, you know, remember we've got that budding concept coming from Brahmanism, you know, where it can be thought of in certain ways as the absolute, right? Or, you know, sort of the truth of the real fact, the absolute. And so that abstraction is to be found up there too, alongside absolute truth, and then you can think about the truth of the absolute. See, now that's obviously getting pretty abstract. Truth is abstract to begin with, right? So it's abstract upon abstract, all at a transcendent ceiling of recognition and absoluteness.
Hard to think it out.
Okay, right? But nonetheless, I mean, everyone should be doing that, not just them. That's a worthy pursuit. I said it way, you know, back an hour ago. Right? That's your eternal journey of striving for that recognition at the ceiling. You know, through endless cycles of eternity and co-absoluteness, you will play, you know, with a recognition at that level. Right? Absolute truth and the truth of the absolute. So, you know, just, all, you know, never being satisfied with the ceiling you find yourself with, always seeking to blow that ceiling off and establish an ever higher ceiling.
Right? Don't punish yourself.
Right? You're content at the level you're at with its ceiling, but you're not satisfied. Right? You're moving towards a higher contentment with a higher ceiling, followed by a yet higher contentment with a yet higher ceiling. And right?
And for some of us, like myself, you know, I find it hard sometimes to get, you know, you say you're not content, you move, but really don't know how to move. Or you have the desire, but, you know, and I say to myself, well, when I'm not going to get in this life, I'll get in the next, you know, it's, I'm not going to get there tomorrow.
Yeah, well that, see, it lines up with this whole the way thing that we're talking about here. You know, just see, they had a great, that's a great thought. Right? See yourself, you know, on a path, an ever ascending, never ending path. Right? That there's a way to your life. That's a great thought. Right? That's an that's a way of kind of expressing what I was just talking about, how, you know, just, you know, you have a series of levels of wholeness that, within which you're content, but you're not satisfied because you know there's an ever greater wholeness that you can seek for. Right? Yeah. But it's important to not let someone make you discontent at the level of wholeness that you're at. See, that's the beginnings of rebellion. First, they sow discontent, right? You know, because they get you to blur the difference between contentment and satisfaction. Right? They falsely existentialize contentment. So they sow discontent, right? And then they sow resistance, and then they sow rebellion. You must be content. You know, and it's not delusional. Like I was saying, there is a wholeness there. This is not a delusional contentment. It's a real contentment. There really is a wholeness that you can be content within at the level you're at.
Yeah. And there's a peace that's above the understanding of the whole that you're in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. These are very, very important things that are very much in play, why the book is in my lap, why there's an emergency. Right? If you can't, you know, keep from existentializing the things where you blur the separation between contentment and satisfaction, you're wholest, right? You're ripe for being taken off into rebellion. All right.
The evolution of a high concept of the absolute was achieved through many channels of thought by devious paths of reasoning. The upper descent of this doctrine of infinity was not so clearly defined as was the evolution of the God concept in Hebrew theology. Nevertheless, there were certain broad levels which the minds of the Buddhists reached, tarried upon, and passed through on their way to envisioning the primal source of the universes.
In other words, like I said before, if you try to actually read some of the stuff that they've thought and try to express it, you know, it's very complicated because they don't really know what they're talking about, but they're trying. And all is said and done, like they're saying, it doesn't have that kind of more Hebraic linearity of evolution. You know, it's sort of, you know, groping around in a very nonlinear way, but ever so slowly, in spite of themselves, you know, drifting upward in recognition. Okay, so they're just saying, you know, don't worry about all the minutia if you try to engage this sort of technically or scientifically. Just appreciate that that's what was going on in the midst of all this, all these fancy terms that they come with, up with, and whatnot. You know, what they're getting at is they're slowly trying to move up in recognition in their ignorance. Okay, so they're going to give you these kind of these basic three points about this.
One, the Gautama legend. At the base of the concept was the historic fact of the life and teachings of Siddhartha, the prophet prince of India. This legend grew in myth as it traveled through the centuries and across the broad lands of Asia until it surpassed the status of the idea of Gautama as the enlightened one and began to take on additional attributes.
Okay, so in other words, it's a bottom-up exercise, not a surprise. Okay, that's the way, you know, we always start. I mean, the fifth epical revelation is the first opportunity we have to really do otherwise, right? Because you can't generate the metaphysics from the bottom up. It has to be handed to you from the top down. Right? So there's really never been a way to approach things in a more top-down fashion until now.
That's why they start with God.
Right. And, yeah, no matter what, you know, what it is. I mean, if it's philosophy, they start with deity. If it's religion, they start with God. Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, I mean, philosophically, the book starts with deity at the top. Religiously, it starts with God at the top. Right, I mean, it tries to help you get that top-down perspective. Okay,
before
but
you go on, I just want to ask a question on what you said about the last one about being content. Is that kind of like the reason Jesus kept telling everybody to be of good cheer?
Yes, be content. Right.
Yeah, no matter what,
Don't be discontented. Yeah. I mean, sure, it's not perfect. That's not news. Right? There's a contentment to be found. No matter how lowly the estate. Okay.
Look at his emphasis on peace be upon you. You admonish that constantly. Peace, my peace I leave with you. Mm-hmm. All that. Don't worry, be happy.
Peace be upon you, right? The upon is so important. Not peace be with you, that horizontal thing. No, get the vertical sense. Because it's only when you see it from the top down that you can be content and that you can stand unmoved when someone tries to make you otherwise, right? Get you to join a revolution.
Yeah.
Right? So that's, you know, that's, yeah, that all that is, yeah, it's all saying the same thing.
Say, my peace I leave with you, because his peace was that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. But when you just, you know, walked in and you say, peace be upon you, right? Yeah. Right? Just, you know, saying it in a vertical instead of a horizontal fashion, right? If you could just get Christians to change their greeting from a horizontal greeting to a vertical greeting, that would be a step up. Literally. Get him to say, peace be upon you, instead of peace be with you. Now, and they won't even recognize it, but it'll put their mind in a better state.
Yeah.
Okay.
Two, the many Buddhas. It was reasoned that if Gautama had come to the peoples of India, then in the remote past and in the remote future, the races of mankind must have been, and undoubtedly would be, blessed with other teachers of truth. This gave rise to the teaching that there were many Buddhas, an unlimited and infinite number, even that anyone could aspire to become one, to attain the divinity of a Buddha.
And in that enlightened state. Yeah, see, and obviously it becomes, you know, in short order, thought of quite literally. I mean, there's an infinitely remote past and an infinitely remote future. You're populated by an infinite number of living Buddhas. See, so it just becomes this hopelessly complicated thing, you know. And, you know, as the murals and paintings and whatnot progressed in Buddhism, you know, you started to get it, you know, populated by this endless proliferation of Buddhas, you know. At the very least, you know, a particular sect, you know, would point to their definitive, you know, such and so number of precedent Buddhas.
Offshoot from Brahmanism in a way?
Kind of yeah, like I said, see, I mean, you know, once, just like Hinduism, you know, subsequent to you know, just pure Brahmanism, you know, got into the whole avatars of Vishnu, right? I mean, it just produces, you know, this endless proliferation.
But inasmuch as the divine Buddha is, could be, the truth of it as the thought adjuster, there are
right
many
right and again see I mean it's not I mean, they start thinking about infinity, and it's very logically recognized that infinity has consequences. It's just that they try to itemize infinity in a very childish way, you know, like a whole bunch of avatars or a whole bunch of Buddhas, as opposed to no, there's a vast cosmos of beings, you know, more flavors of beings than you can even conceive of the number of. And but, you know, all they've got is Earth and its past and its future. Right? And so you try to make infinity play out here, see, instead of in the cosmos infinite. Right?
Which leads to that supreme philosophic blunder.
And obviously, you know, as these proliferate, you're going to have all sorts of sects that will focus on one over others, and then, you know, have a, like I said, a special subset around that you know, most favored one amongst the many, you know, and so you just start to get all of this complexity, just like in Hinduism.
Three, the absolute Buddha. By the time the number of Buddhas was approaching infinity, it became necessary for the minds of those days to reunify this unwieldy concept. Accordingly, it began to be taught that all Buddhas were but the manifestation of some higher essence, some eternal one of infinite and unqualified existence, some absolute source of all reality. From here on, the deity concept of Buddhism in its highest form becomes divorced from the human person of Gautama Siddhartha and casts off from the anthropomorphic limitations which have held it in leash. This final conception of the Buddha, eternal, can well be identified as the absolute, sometimes even as the infinite I am.
Right. See, so notice the difference, right? I mean, you know, in that, you know, Brahmanic tradition directly, you know, in India, by the time you got to this level of trying to sort the menagerie out logically, you ended up with the absolute, in a sense, But it was, you know, on the other hand, the infinite it is, not the infinite I am. So even though on its surface, see, they're just reminding you, on its surface it appears to be no different. That it's like, well, why isn't it the infinite it is? I don't see any sign of personality here. It's like, well, hidden, sort of unrecognized, is a certain flavor that can be taken to a direct personality or direct personalization again. Right, I mean, you know, in the Urantia book, they use the I am not as a descriptor of an actuality, right? But the descriptor, you know, not even as a descriptor of a potentiality, but as a descriptor of a concept, an originating concept, right? You know, it's just this concept, and out of it, you unpack reality. Say, okay. See, so they're telling you that they're getting all the way to a most transcendent kind of founding concept, but it's pregnant with the potential to unpack personality out of it instead of just, you know, non-personal objects. Yeah, you know, it's a different kind of a founding concept. Right? In the Urantia book, the I am is not personal, right? It's, like I said, it's just a concept, right? You know, it's prior to any differentiation that you can label in any way, shape, or form. It's completely unqualified. Okay, and it's just a concept, but it's pregnant with a personalizable potential, if you will. Okay. Well, you as a person, all personality. Right, see, that's the problem, you know. If you go totally if you start with the infinite, it is, then, you know, it's not that you don't have the universal father as a person. You don't have any persons. I'm not a person. Right? I'm just a fancy self. Okay? Right?
Yeah. It's the contemplation of the source of all things being less than the manifestation.
And it's a general problem with, you know, all kinds of philosophic traditions in the West as well, where you know, the failure to recognize, to abstract personality from self, to recognize the separate fact of personality from self. I mean, no one has done it. It doesn't matter how many authors you can find using the word personality. No, look at it. They aren't really talking about personality. The word personality, because it's in the Urantia book, becomes a taking name for you. Now anyone can just say personality. Go, oh, look at they know the Urantia book. It's like, no, they don't have any clue about the reality of personality. They're talking about self. Can't you see?
They're connected in a way because it's totally unique.
Personality is absolutely unique, but self isn't. Right? There's types of self.
But selfhood is.
But are you unique?
Your personality is absolutely unique. Right. See, again, remember, they're not the same. I mean, in one sense, they're opposites. Okay. Personality is self is an upwelling phenomenon, and personality is a downwelling phenomenon. You know, self is coming up from time. Personality is coming down from eternity. Right, and they're meeting. Right, the top down identifies with the bottom up. Right? And at the point where they meet, you have a personalized self. You have a self under the influence of a personality, of a spirit pattern. Right? You know, it colors the upwelling self, but the personality itself is separate. Okay? And again, it's initially confusing. Because in the Urantia book, they use the word personality for two different things. They use it for the personality itself, and they use it as shorthand for personalized self. Right? You know, a lot of times they're talking about, you know, that personality. They're not talking abstractly about the personality itself. They're talking about that personalized self. Right? You have to, you know, notice in the context which they're talking about. Right? And occasionally when they want you to just set the self aside and focus on just the personality itself, they literally say, the personality itself. Right, forget about the self. that's what they're telling you there. Just the spirit pattern. Right?
Which is different than the spirit of God within you. because that's right. How they
completely different. So to speak. Yeah, yeah.
That's how the Spirit of God gets personality, right?
Right. See again the you know, that you know that that thought adjuster, you know, as a self, is an ascending sun. Right, it's moving up in experiential nature. It doesn't matter that it started with an existential core, right? It's moving up in experiential nature as an ascending sun, okay? And it's seeking a personality to identify from the top down with it and personalize it, right? And you know, your adjuster is going to achieve that by first melting yourself and its self together as one self that's moving up, right? And then the personality identifies with that now combined, melted together self.
Yeah. What happens to me?
You're still there too, right? Right? See, that's the thing. See, look how changeable selves are. Right, I can literally fuse myself with another self, the adjuster self, and make it two selves together as one self. Talk about changeable, but the personality is changeless. See, and it's always transcendent, no matter how much you know you change the self or get that super additive consequence of the two selves together as one transcendent self. Right, the personality is always above that, coming down. No matter how high the upwelling, the downwelling is always above it. The personality identification is always transcendent and is attempting to personalize that self.
That's a pretty new and hard concept to grasp, isn't it?
That's the fifth epical revelation, yeah. Whoa. See? It's completely beyond anything that anyone has ever written about, right?
That uniqueness that you were... It's hard to get it.
You know? Very hard to get it.
Until you know, post perfection, that we start to embody that uniqueness that's just shadowy right now, like birth twins. Birth twins you can't really tell them apart much, but in the eternal future, they'll be absolutely unique because they will have grown into their personality.
Yeah, grown up to even up you to. Could say their personality. See. Yeah, and just you know, again, just to put one more little, you know, touch on that. Right, when you think about fusion, you know, think about put your two hands out in front of you. There's two separate selves. There's the adjuster self and yourself. Okay, two separate selves, and fusion is gluing the sides of the two selves together. Okay, so that's you know begins the process of making those two selves one self, and as you move up the local universe. Those two selves are going to progressively infuse until when you leave the local universe as a first stage spirit, that's when the two selves are completely together as one self. Okay? But that whole time, personality has been transcendent to that, you know, and identifying from the top down and personalizing that complex self phenomenon. And she brought in the word selfhood. No matter what the complexity of self nature, there's sort of the sealing thread that all of that self complexity is hanging upon that was put there by grace. That's your selfhood, right? I mean, technically, the personality identifies with that selfhood, the thread of supremacy that the self is suspended from. Because, see, technically, as we were just talking, there's nothing but change about selves. I mean, two selves coming together as one, it's like a crazy amount of change. The personality is changeless. It can't identify directly with changing, especially extremely changing, like we're talking about there. It can only identify with something which is likewise changeless. Right? Relative to the finite, you have a selfhood, a supreme selfhood. It's changeless relative. You know, supremacy doesn't change relative to finity. You know, that's the relationship between supremacy and infinity. Right? So your personality identifies with that changeless selfhood, you know, below which you have this constantly changing self. See, it's a very, very complicated thing when you get into all the physics of it.
Right? Chris, one of the easy ways that you have put it across before is the self is the unparented self, and the selfhood is the ongoing parented. Mm-hmm. Unparented, you know, like a little brat. So...
There's a lot.
I understood.
There's a lot of different ways to analogize it, right? And you know, what I've just said in the last few minutes is just one way. There's a lot of different ways to kind of help your mind get the essence of these new concepts.
Right? So we really don't know our personality that well yet.
No, and see, technically, there's no really knowing it. I mean, it's just this influence from eternity. That is, you can know you have a personality, but not directly. You look back and you notice, my self has changed. It's grown. It's matured. In a certain way. The only way to explain that, because I can see it's not, it's consistent. It's not just, well, changed over this way. Oh, now changed this way. No, now changed that way. No, it's not some arbitrary thing. This change has a consistency to it. There must be a changeless influence being superimposed on myself, right, that is giving a subtle direction to the changes so that they're, you know, a sequence. They're logically connected one to the other, right? And you can't see why, but you can know there's an answer to the why question. Why isn't it just arbitrary, going whatever direction? Why is it moving along a logical line, a sequence? There must be some changeless influence, superimposed, right? That this self is more and more conforming to. Meanwhile, back to the absolute Buddha. All right, so they're pointing out, it's more than just a mere anthropomorphic exaltation process like everyone has always done. They had it all in the context of a pre-existent hierarchy of truth. See, so they can move their anthropomorphic, exalted Gautama concept up through a pre-existent hierarchy of truth frame. See, and so it gives it a real living quality, this anthropomorphism, that other people's anthropomorphisms didn't have. Right? That's what they're getting at. Yep.
While this idea of absolute deity never found great popular favor with the peoples of Asia, it did enable the intellectuals of these lands to unify their philosophy and to harmonize their cosmology. The concept of the Buddha, absolute, is at times quasi-personal, at times wholly impersonal, even an infinite creative force. Such concepts, though helpful to philosophy, are not vital to religious development. Even an anthropomorphic Yahweh is of greater religious value than an infinitely remote absolute of Buddhism or Brahmanism.
I was kind of just saying that before. Right? I mean, again, one reason you know this isn't merely a religious text is the first section in the foreword is not about God, it's about deity. You don't need deity for religion. You just need God. But to put religion in the context, that part that is religion in the context of the whole, right, to make it true religion, to put it in a philosophic frame, you need deity. You need something that's transcendent of God. Right? So they're, just reminding you that, the degree to which, you kind of, in a very subtle, immature way, can get a God notion by exalting the volcano, anthropomorphic volcano God, Yahweh, and that finds a living resonance with your religious impulse, that the seemingly completely devitalized, fuzzed out absolute, like you're saying, of Brahmanism or Buddhism, doesn't. Right? You need this vitalized nucleus, because that's the whole point, remember, to have a faith nucleus, have that religious nucleus. I mean, it has to be this sort of infinitely vital, dynamic core that you can build your real self around, right? The absolute of Buddhism or Brahmanism is the exact, the absolute opposite of that, as de-individuated, denuclearized as you can get concept. So it lacks religious vitality, okay? But it's very important philosophically, right? To transcend individuality and get to philosophic unity with deity, that's very important to have a philosophic frame to put science and religion into. And that's why the book starts with deity. Okay. That's, but like they're saying, I mean, such concepts, met with totally deaf ears for the common person. Yeah. That's just looking for something to help them with their fears and stuff.
Isn't a cosmology without God still short of the whole? I mean, isn't God part of the whole?
Of course. Right. I mean, God is a very important part in the context of the whole. Right. Of course. Right. But again, just, you want a real God, which means you've got to find the whole and then rediscover the God part, just like I was saying about yourself. You don't know your real self until you look at yourself in the context of the whole. Otherwise, the perspective is innately delusional, right? It appears you're the center of the universe, and you're looking at everything from that vantage point. That's just, not an objective viewpoint.
At times, the absolute was even thought of as contained within the infinite I Am. But these speculations were chill comfort to the hungry multitudes who craved to hear words of promise, to hear the simple gospel of Salem, that faith in God would assure divine favor and eternal survival.
Right, as I was just saying. See, chill comfort for the hungry multitudes who fundamentally, right, are just worried about divine favor and survival. Last week we talked a lot about the word salvation, being saved, and the different ways that you can think of yourself or some part of yourself being saved, or saved from something, or whatever. Okay. The companion word is survival, right? Which is literally live above, survive, above live. Right? And, so that, getting, not just being saved, say, from suffering, but what about ongoing living. I'm living here, and if you start to imagine that it isn't just a horizontal picture, that there's a vertical dimension, it's like, well, do I get to live above? Do I get to move up in this hierarchy, or am I, constrained to the plane? Right? So, initially you're thinking about temporal living above, temporal survival, But eventually, you know, you get all the way up to the absolute Buddha, the eternal Buddha, you know, the eternal one, what have you. I mean, you start to think, well, what about eternal survival? Right? Can I live above in eternity? Does that even make sense? You know, what does that mean? You start playing around with those things. But because we're encircled in the Holy Spirit by grace, even the most simple person that's just fraught with fear and of death and what have you, existentializes that those fears, right? And they may not say it, but they're really fraught with the fear of not achieving eternal survival. Even though no philosopher has ever tried to explain the difference between eternality and temporality or whatever, right? So
many people I know say, well, whatever happens, happens. You know, I don't really want to think about it. Or, can anybody else ever hear that?
Sure. Right. I mean, most people are very prosaic, you know. And
But a lot of people, there's an unrecognized fear.
Yeah.
If you've never grappled with it.
When you get to it, you mean?
And
as you're approaching, yes, it always
going to... And come to a determination for yourself, then it's part of the unknown. And
very simple people whistle past graveyards, right? There's something there, right? I mean, they're not whistling like that, you know, in their day-to-day life, right? But, you know, just, you know, it brings those thoughts to bear. You know, if you're approaching death, you know, if you're, you know, very sick or something, or, you know, or whatever, literally just walking past the graveyard, and you say, like, well, there's that other question, you know, right? What about, you know, beyond the immediate pleasures? You aren't as carefree as a pure animal, right? Because of that encirclement in the Holy Spirit. You know, it adds a whole new level of potential fear to your life to be given that spiritualization of your mind, you know, all the way to the point of a fear tied to eternity, not merely to time. How scary is that? Right? Now, what about a fear that I, you know, that time won't fix? You know, it's just there, inescapably, eternity. Right? See, that's what it's that kind of basic recognition that's driven religion ever since its earliest days. Right? That existentialization of things like that. Yeah. I don't just fear, I dread. See, you're existentializing a little bit.
Yeah, fear with interest.
Yes. Fear with shadows of eternity. All right. Okay.
12. The God concept of Buddhism. The great weakness in the cosmology of Buddhism was twofold. Its contamination with many of the superstitions of India and China, and its sublimation of Gautama, first as the enlightened one, and then as the eternal Buddha. Just as Christianity has suffered from the absorption of much erroneous human philosophy, so does Buddhism bear its human birthmark. But the teachings of Gautama have continued to evolve during the past 2.5 millenniums. The concept of Buddha to an enlightened Buddhist is no more the human personality of Gautama than the concept of Jehovah is identical with the spirit demon of Horeb to an enlightened Christian. Paucity of terminology, together with the sentimental retention of olden nomenclature, is often provocative of the failure to understand the true significance of the evolution of religious concepts.
Okay, it's quite a bit there. But notice how they're showing, because these material gravity drags everything down into the natural state, or tends to drag everything down. It doesn't matter if you're talking about Buddhism with Gautama or Christianity with Jesus. you end up with the same problem, right? You not only have the sublimation of Gautama, you have the sublimation of Jesus. And even starting to celebrate his birth, in the fourth century, didn't completely fix that, right? So that you've got to have a culminating paper in this book whose first section is Jesus, the man, right? Right. There's an importance, to Gautama, the man, and not just an ever more abstract exaltation woo-woo, right? Right, it becomes ungrounded, right? It's, so heavenly-minded, an upper domain with no lower domain, right? Right. You get this bifurcated sense of things. So, note that. The fifth epical revelation is still trying to fix the sublimation of Jesus. We talked about last time, the fourth epical revelation is not the life and teachings of Jesus. Fourth epical revelation is Jesus of Nazareth. Right? Don't abstract and exalt his life and teachings, No, it's innate in Jesus the man. Right? Think of in physics terms of sublimation, going from a solid to a gas. Right? From the solidity of Jesus the man to the gas of some mystical musings, right? Coming up off of him.
Just like his first bestowal was Jesus the Melchizedek.
What was that?
Just like his first bestowal was Jesus the Melchizedek, wasn't he?
Yeah, right, yeah. The first bestowal, right, is when he incarnated as a Melchizedek, yes. Right.
So that's the whole,
okay. Yeah.
That's God doing him.
Right, yeah. Literally there, right? It's not some abstract faith. It's the faith of Jesus the man, right? If you divorce it from the man, it's not real faith that you're contemplating. It's some silly abstraction, okay?
And it's not achievable by a mortal.
And it's not achievable by any real human, right? Okay, so there's that. Let's see. But the lectus sees, they're getting us to this crescendo. Now, but, despite all of this stuff, all this superstitions and erroneous falderal, but the teachings of Gautama have continued to evolve during the past two and one half millenniums. Right? And they're reminding you, again, the parallel. No matter how superstitious and whatnot, a Christian might be, at least he's not literally thinking that God, is the volcano God, right? As they're saying right there, the spirit demon of Horeb, Mount Sinai, right? The volcano, right? At least they're not that simplistically, literal about it. Like they said, they may still call him, by the same name, basically. It's actually a little bit helpful if you use the vowels of Adonai and the consonants of Yahweh to make the artificial word Jehovah. That at least bounds that designation a little bit away from literally the spirit demon of Horeb, Yahweh literally, right? The volcano god. So in that ignorance of blurring the two words together to get Jehovah, it's like, well, okay, we can work with that. That's unwittingly helpful, right? No one was calling the volcano god Jehovah. Okay. So that it isn't quite as the retention of olden nomenclature like they're saying there. It's a little bit of a step removed. But anyway, like they're saying, the retention of various things. A lot of people falsely judge religionists by the appearance of their words. It's like, well, these are primitive words. This is a primitive thinker. Okay, not really. He's just still using the old words, but he's using them in a new fashion. Okay, you shouldn't judge the book by its cover. Okay?
Gradually, the concept of God, as contrasted with the absolute, began to appear in Buddhism. Its sources are back in the early days of this differentiation of the followers of the lesser road and the greater road. It was among the later divisions, latter division of Buddhism, that the dual conception of God and the absolute finally matured. Step by step, century by century, the God concept has evolved until, with the teachings of Ryōnin, Hōnin Shōnin, and Shinran in Japan, this concept finally came to fruit in the belief in Amida Buddha.
Okay, so we finally get, you know, God and the absolute attempting to be separated and considered. Okay, a personal, that potential inherent in calling it the infinite I am, say, is finally actualized as some, you know, more definitively personalized but very transcendent concept. Obviously, the greater road, as they said, you know, the latter division, is going to be the source of this. Not going to be found on the lesser road. And you know, so you have that chronological sequence of Buddhist monks in Japan, Ryōnin, Hōnin, and Shinran. You know, in the 12th and 13th centuries. You know, in other words, the end of the Middle Ages, right? Finally, really bringing this separation into focus. You know, the Shōnin, you know, that's the honorific title. You know, you could call him Shinran Shōnin too. They put it on Hōnin because, you know, he's kind of the central founding figure for this flavor of Buddhism. Thinks in terms of Amida Buddha. Amida means infinite. Right? So, we had the absolute Buddha up there. You're kind of in that same mode. This is infinite Buddha. Right? But it's, you know, the Universal Father is an infinite person. So that's the process. So, you know, you had to get it up, you know, in that kind of philosophic abstraction, like they said up there, the better minds, the philosophers in Buddhism needed to sort out this menagerie with the infinite number of living Buddhas and all that sort of stuff, right? So you get the philosophic material, and then you coalesce a personal God concept out of that philosophic material. Just like you personalize deity out of deity. Okay. What eventually is the Shin sect, you know, Shin Buddhism, you know, coming from Shinran, right, that you know, comes into play. All right.
Among these believers, it is taught that the soul, upon experiencing death, may elect to enjoy a sojourn in paradise prior to entering nirvana, the ultimate of existence. It is proclaimed that this new salvation is attained by faith in the divine mercies and loving care of Amida, God of the paradise in the West. In their philosophy, the Amidists hold to an infinite reality, which is beyond all finite mortal comprehension. In their religion, they cling to faith in the all-merciful Amida, who so loves the world that he will not suffer one mortal who calls on his name in true faith and with a pure heart to fail in the attainment of the supernal happiness of paradise.
Right. So yeah. See, notice now, I mean, you can't read something, you know, that sounds like this, but see, what, again, this is very much what I told you the revelators are doing for you here. They're taking all of the kind of fuzzy gobbledygook and saying, okay, what they're really saying here, in essence, is this, right? Let's put it in definitive terms, right? You know, and you are getting, you know, a paradise concept where you can be as an individual. Maybe you're not totally getting rid of, well, sometime way in the future you might melt as a drop of water in an ocean, okay? But at least you're getting, you know, a concept of a very exalted state where as an individual you're in this domain of happiness. You're in this paradise, okay? You know, you're doing that by identifying, you know, in a way that is appropriately called faith, with an all-merciful, infinite being. Okay? See? So, right, and, you know, and, you know, who so loves the world, right? The God so loved the world. I mean, so they're obviously playing off of the New Testament on purpose. It's to show you that, you know, even though they're not saying that, okay, in truth, that's what they're, that's how you can distill what they're saying, what they're thinking. They've got the essence of it in truth.
Reverse of sublimation.
What's the parenthetical God of the paradise in the West?
Oh, yeah, I was going to get to that. So the reason it's in the West is, you know, you're thinking about making this identification so that you can survive above. You know, so the sun rises in the east and sets, dies in the west, right? So this, okay, right, you're just translating the setting sun in the west to where, you know, you sort of go in some mystical fashion, you know, when you die and where you survive above, right? Yeah, that's a very common thing, both in the east and the west, right? You have the elves sailing to the west, not the east, right? Because the sun sets in the west. That's why you're just, yeah, you know, they're using that, you know, they're using that solar fact to, you know, at, you know, to
so what you're saying is
work bottom up into a concept.
Yep. You won't read this in Wikipedia, what they're doing. In other words, when you
you'll read about the West, and you'll read about.
What I mean is this whole concept of a distillation.
Yeah.
So read it somewhere else, but what they're telling you is what's really going on.
So precisely, cleanly expressed, you know, without all of the other silliness, right? Clear out all the mishmash and just what's the core essence that they're trying to, you know, get focused on. This is it.
Buddhists recognize that, do they?
Well, see, they're giving you this. It's like you could help them with that focusing process. And just let go of some of the falderal that's still kind of keeping you from bringing this to a clear focus. You know, they're about to say that here. Okay.
This is like clinically pure compared to, you know, like authoritative elimination of error.
Yeah.
Purity.
Right. It's they're coordinating essential knowledge here, see. Yeah. You know, and they're giving you these wonderful tight little descriptions of what's there.
The great strength of Buddhism is that its adherents are free to choose truth from all religions. Such freedom of choice has seldom characterized a Urantian faith. In this respect, the Shin sect of Japan has become one of the most progressive religious groups in the world. It has revived the ancient missionary spirit of Gautama's followers, and has begun to send teachers to other peoples. This willingness to appropriate truth from any and all sources is indeed a commendable tendency to appear among religious believers during the first half of the 20th century after Christ.
Now, if you could just get them to focus that, you know, they reach out to get a hold of other threads, but there's a tendency without a focusing assistance like the fifth epical revelation, for you to kind of just diffuse and kind of get lost, right? Right? You potentialize it, but you can't focus and really actualize it. You know, you kind of just get diffused out in every direction. It's like, well, what about the butterfly in Buddhism, and what about the butterfly in, you know, in Hinduism, and what, you know, and you just end up just you know, spreading out and can't really bring it to a focus. Like I said, the revelation is great for taking diffused thoughts of humans and bringing them to a nice, clean focus in a crisp little paragraph, right? Instead of 500 books of muddle, right, it's one paragraph. Right? All there. So, you know, they're trying to help us with this.
If you can keep it.
Yeah, if you can keep it, yes. Yeah. Here's the focus, if you can keep it. Exactly. But notice that they're one of the final things they're saying is some of that latent missionary spirit from the Melchizedek missionaries. Remember, we are reading about the Melchizedek missionaries here, right? You know, is manifesting again, right? And you know that those Japanese, you know, that were of the Shin sect got spread all over the place in North America and whatnot. Right.
Buddhism itself is undergoing a 20th century renaissance. Through contact with Christianity, the social aspects of Buddhism have been greatly enhanced. The desire to learn has been rekindled in the hearts of the monk priests of the Brotherhood, and the spread of education throughout this faith will be certainly provocative of new advances in religious evolution.
That is, if it doesn't all get lost in the Enlightenment, of course, like Chris was just saying, if you can keep it, right? The Rancho Book came in this wonderful potentialized time at the beginning of the 20th century for a reason, yeah. But right, it's not an enduring state, you know. If you don't take a hold of that, it's all going to get lost in the, you know, growing Enlightenment of the rest of the 20th century, and now, you know, a couple decades of the 21st.
Well, there is some positiveness.
There's all kinds of positiveness. See, again, it's all there. Like I've said so many times, all you have to do is you have to go back to the beginning of the 20th century. Take a hold of what's there. You know, whether it's religious potential, philosophic potential, scientific potential, take a hold of what's there and take it forward anew so that it goes forward in truth instead of in falsehood, like it's been doing for 100 years now. Right? It's getting worse and worse, and he's got to go back there and start again. All right. Let's see, anything else there? Just, you know, that whole bit of being asocial, especially in the lesser road, but see, it's still lingering in the greater road too, like they're saying, and so it really helps to engage Christians with all of their social focus, right? That helps to get them out of their monastery mode more. And all of the education of Western civilization, that helps them too. Right.
At the time of this writing, much of Asia rests its hope in Buddhism. Will this noble faith that has so valiantly carried on through the dark ages of the past once again receive the truth of expanded cosmic realities, even as the disciples of the great teacher in India once listened to his proclamation of new truth? Will this ancient faith respond once more to the invigorating stimulus of the presentation of new concepts of God and the Absolute for which it has so long searched?
See, they're telling us, like, okay, You Buddhists, right? You've been searching for a very solid, focused, clarified recognition of God, and in contrast, the Absolute. Here it is. What you've been searching for 20, you know, for 2.5 millennia, right? It's here to be found if you can see. You know, if you can let go of some of the falderal that you've got, right? Just go to your core essence, like you saw the Melchizedek, you know, synopsize your thoughts about Amida Buddha, for instance, right here in this paragraph. Now, if you can do likewise, bring it to a clean focus and let go of all of the, you know, Indian-based fall draw and whatnot. Okay, yeah, it's here, the God you've been always looking for and the absolute you've always been looking for are here.
In English.
In English, yes.
So much of the hope of the Asian people.
Yes, you Buddhism, like you're saying, because it's the people that haven't totally diffused the potential to personalize out of their thinking, right? Their thinking might be impersonal, but it's potentially personal.
Different than Confucianism.
You know, different than a lot of other things that, you know, yeah, especially, I mean, Confucianism just, you know, is all about ethics and stuff. It gets kind of lost in just, you know, the human, you know, in the plane. All right.
All Urantia is waiting for the proclamation of the ennobling message of Michael. Unencumbered by the accumulated doctrines and dogmas of 19 centuries of contact with the religions of evolutionary origin, the hour is striking for presenting to Buddhism, to Christianity, to Hinduism, even to the peoples of all faiths, not the gospel about Jesus, but the living spiritual reality of the gospel of Jesus, presented by Melchizedek of Nabadon.
Yeah.
Great paragraph. Yeah.
Right. Of course, it's a classic paragraph, but again, that paragraph is devitalized if you are still in the old wineskins, right? You know, and you know, if what you go out with is just these words, that, you know, you're proselytizing the religion of Jesus instead of the religion about Jesus, but the person can see that you're just another flavor of the religion about Jesus. Did I say it backwards? I mean, they can tell if you're just giving reworked religion about Jesus.
Well, it says living, so you can't do anything with that.
Right? I mean, you have to lead with the gospel, right? The fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. You can't lead with Jesus.
That's why they say ennobling measures of Michael versus Jesus.
Right? I mean, it's so important, right, that you don't lead with Jesus, right? You lead with God, right? Because if you lead with Jesus, no matter how much you say otherwise, you're saying you should adopt this religion about Jesus, right? I know it's a fine line in many cases, but it's an important line, right? Jesus didn't go about talking about himself, right? If you're going to be a disciple of Jesus, you got to do likewise. You go out talking about God and your relationship to God.
The new religion about the Spirit of God that lives right within the mind of men.
Right. I mean, it's really cool to have the details of the life and teachings of Jesus, but that's not the gospel, right? I keep emphasizing that, you know, because it's just so difficult. Remember, your natural tendency is going to do that. I mean, just like we're reading about the natural tendency, Gautama was such a cool guy, you know. It's so easy to just kind of unwittingly start exalting him and, you know, and focusing, right, and abstracting from him, right, and eventually you lose sight of what he was trying to get you to think about, just like we lost sight of what Jesus was trying to get us to think about, because we're so fascinated by, you know, how he talked or, you know, how he engaged someone, and that's wonderful, okay, but it's just, that's not the core.
So can you talk about the real spiritual reality of the gospel of Jesus without mentioning Jesus?
Yeah, I just did. The gospel of Jesus is the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. I mean, right. You know, you can go right to the end of paper 195. The hope of modern Christianity is that it should cease to sponsor the social systems and industrial policies of Western civilization while it humbly bows itself before the cross it so valiantly extols, there to learn anew from Jesus of Nazareth the greatest truths mortal man can ever hear, the living gospel of the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. Right? That's the greatest truths mortal man can ever hear.
And that which we most need to know.
Right. All right. All right. So, I mean, yes, I mean, Jesus is a great, you know, context, you know, through which to get that. But the point is to go through Jesus to get that. Right? I'm the way. I'm not the end point. I'm the way, he said. Right? Through me you can recognize the Father of God and the brother of man. Yeah. But don't stall out in me. Right. The path, the way, right? That's the important thing. Okay. So, I mean, obviously we could talk endlessly about, you know, all this, but for the time being, next week we'll move on to the Levant. And see how things played out a little bit closer to where those prior epical revelations were laid down. See what kind of a flavor they get through their evolutionary process there as the Melchizedek missionaries come into play. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.